Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello and welcome to this episode number 179 of the Free Cities Podcast. Yes, welcome, welcome to the centre of the global movement to build freer societies. That's right. And welcome here to where I am right now, which is one of those centres, Prospera. And this will be the last time I will be recording an episode intro from here. Alas, my 1 month sabbatical here in Prospera is almost over. Certainly one of the most productive months I've spent in, I would say, many years. And in fact, I would highly recommend this kind of short sabbatical to any of you out there if you're certainly revolving in these circles, at least. In fact, for me now, this will be a concrete part of my yearly itinerary going forwards. 1 month in Prospera every year for the foreseeable future. And if you're thinking of doing this, which I would highly recommend, as I say, I will offer you some advice before you come. Manage your expectations before you get here. I've noticed that some people come here expecting something and they don't necessarily find it. For example, if you're coming here looking for Tulum in Mexico, you know that place, that kind of a vibe, you'd be wrong at the moment. Almost certainly in the future, things like that will be happening, but right now, Prospera, this place, is here for builders, as far as I'm concerned, and also for the curious, of course, but you should come here for the opportunities. This is a frontier, after all. And in fact, you could say currently this is the frontier if you're in this world like I am. Anyway, come and see what's working here. Come and see what's not working here also, and learn. This is, after all, one of the most compelling models evolving in real time as you live here anyway. Talking of Free Cities models, it's a spectrum, as you know, and the Free Cities podcast lead sponsor has one such model on that spectrum. It's Veritas Villages, of course, and they are building off-grid, freedom-oriented communities across Latin America, designed for people who value sovereignty, resilience, and a higher degree of personal autonomy. Now, a couple of interesting updates from the Veritas Villages camp today. They have their own podcast. It's called Freedom Lovers Life. And they've just dropped an episode which I found incredibly interesting. It's basically Patrick, the CEO, and his COO, a gentleman called Eric Vick, discussing exit taxes and rising wealth taxes and what those trends could mean for individuals and families looking to protect their future. For me, it was a very sobering watch. It's a well put together slideshow of pretty much what you're up against if, like me, you're living in Europe right now. Anyway, definitely give that one a watch. Link in the show notes, of course. Also, Veritas Villages have an upcoming webinar on April the 28th. It's being given by Altris, which are their parent company, called Land, Lifestyle and Bitcoin, Investor Overview of Altris Group. Now, it's 1 p.m. Eastern Time on April the 28th. This session will provide an overview of Altris, their communities, and how they're building across Latin America. You can register on LinkedIn, or you can just tune in and watch on YouTube. Links in the description. Right, today's show. And this week, we are exploring the real story behind Sealand, the self-declared micronation built on an old abandoned UK military sea fort in the North Sea, and is about the family that risked everything to create and defend it. Now, what many, myself included, used to at least superficially think of as a curiosity or just a stunt, will actually quickly reveal itself as something far more serious than that. This conversation traces how one decision to step outside of the existing system led to decades of persistence, conflict, commitment, and basically showing what it actually looks like to attempt sovereignty in the real world, not just the theory, and you know how much we're into that on this channel. I'm speaking today with Liam Bates, aka Liam of Sealand. He's a prince, believe it or not, grandson of Paddy Roy Bates, the man who originally claimed Sealand back in 1967. More broadly, this episode examines the gap between ideas and execution. In a world where it's easy to discuss alternative governance, freedom, and new jurisdictions, Sealand stands out as a pretty rare case of people who simply just went ahead and did it. And that's a strategy that's not going to sit comfortably with everyone. But as you will find out with Liam, it's totally second nature. Their story highlights the costs, trade-offs, and resilience required to hold on to something unconventional over time. It also raises a larger question. In an era shaped by regulation, safety, and incremental changes in the wrong direction, as far as I'm concerned, who is still willing to take meaningful risks to build something truly independent? And what does that path actually demand? The Sealand story is a pretty radical one, even though I say so myself. But like I said earlier, it isn't for Liam. Him and his brother have got massive plans for Sealand. And I'll be honest, I had no idea until this conversation. Anyway, enjoy the chat. Links in the show notes if you want to investigate more or support Sealand or get one of their titles. Prince, princess, duchess, whatever. It's all in the show notes. Right, top supporters this week on the Value for Value platforms. 1, Aaron. 2, Shadrach. 3, Christopher Albanese. 4, ANT. 5, Matthias. Many thanks, Value for Value subscribers and donators and streamers of Bitcoin. Some comments, Justin Bianchi, great to hear all the updates and visions of Prospera. That's Gabe Delgado's episode 177. Can't wait for the doc. That's episode 175. Oswald Horowitz, nor can I. I can't wait for that documentary either. And on and on says the UK is beyond repair. That's the James Price episode 176. Would I agree with that? I have no idea. I feel that. I'd love it not to be true, but I kind of sense it might be. Anyway, don't forget to subscribe on fountain.fm and review us, please, anywhere on any of the platforms you listen. We're reaching more and more people every week. Many, 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 many thanks to everyone who supports us. And now for the conversation. I'm rushing a bit here, but I've got so much to get on with before I leave Prospera. Time to make Sealand great again. Just sit back, relax, as always, and enjoy my conversation with Liam Bates. Like I say, I didn't know a huge amount about you guys, and I knew about Sealand because it's a bit of a myth in the UK, isn't it? Yeah. Like everyone, but I never made the connection between what we do and what you guys are doing. So I had a bit of a dig last night, not a deep dive, but I watched the 60 Minutes documentary, mate. It's insane. Do you know what I thought watching that was? You couldn't get away with that now, could you? Mm. You know how polite everyone was.
Yeah, I think there's several parts to why we were able to get away with it. I think at the time it was kind of the start of that identity crisis for the UK. I think they were very nervous to be seen to be acting against people. You know, as the empire was kind of winding down and all that. I think it was in that period. And there was all sorts of places declaring independence from the UK, and they didn't want to be seen to be, you know, using the military to remove my family. And my family were obviously very clear that that was going to be the only way that was going to happen. And I don't think the UK had the appetite for it.
No. Just a word of warning, try not to bang the tables. Okay. Unfortunately, this is a hollow table. It's a, just be aware. No, it was, I've noticed that when I watch old films now, especially, you know, like news stuff, you realize just how different culture is now. Mm-hmm. Even to the fact, even if you take, you know, the extremes like woke culture and all that kind of nonsense, go back like to that period in time and it just does not exist in any shape or form, you know. But so does a bunch of other stuff. And I was just watching, it's your granddad, isn't it, who started it, right? And just the way, the things he's talking about and the way they're discussing, and your grandma, like, dressed up to the nines, living on this thing. Yeah. It's just, I mean, presumably she kind of did that for the camera, I'm sure. I mean, what do you know about life back then, you know?
I mean, life on Sealand then was very, very tough. They gave themselves a huge challenge. Like, you can't even imagine. Everything had to be taken out there. And even when I was, even when I was younger, it was hard work. You know, we would run the generator for 30 minutes a day. My dad would turn on the little black and white TV, would watch the news and then turn it off, because you didn't know when the next boat could come to give you more diesel. It was always cold. You know, we'd have the little paraffin heater, but the paraffin had to be brought in, had to be carried down, you know, onto boats, on and off boats, lugging everything about. Every aspect of it was difficult. A lot of those things have eased now, you know, with technology, you know, it's quite comfortable out there. But everything was done the hard way, literally everything. But part of that would have been done for the cameras, as you say, with my grandma. But my grandma did live out there, like, with my dad. And she was a very glamorous lady, and she always used to brush her hair and do her makeup and all that kind of thing, even on Sealand, as bizarre as it is.
But it's things like that that shows you how far things have changed since that time. Even the fact that your wife would go out and live there. Your average sort of 21st century wife would be like, no way, I'm not going out there. You know what I mean? It's so weird. And I don't know, it's going to sound a bit weird, but I find it just I find the modern world a little bit disappointing in that sense.
Yeah.
That those kind of things wouldn't happen in the same way now. I was looking at it thinking, holy shit, that would not cut it now.
Yeah, that spirit of adventure is kind of gone. You see it a little bit here in Prospera. You're not a little bit, quite a lot, but that's because people from all over the world that have that spirit of adventure are converging here. But you don't really see it anywhere. I mean, I guess back in those days, people were a lot more used to the adventure. They were used to being sent off to war and those kind of things. And I think that was part of the thing that drove my grandpa to found Sealand, that he was involved in the Second World War from when he was a very young man. You know, he lied about his age, he signed up, he fought in the Spanish Civil War originally when he was a very, very young man. I think for the adventure, obviously fought all the way through the Second World War, through North Africa, the Middle East. And then I think he got back to the UK when the war was over, and I think he was disillusioned with the UK that he saw, as I talked about, you know, with the empire winding down and that adventure leaving, the UK losing its identity. And I don't think he was ready for the adventures to end, to be honest with you. You know, so I think he went out and carved out his own piece of adventure.
I just think it's audacious, the audacity to do that. I'm just trying to think what the equivalent now would be. You know, people's risk appetite is no, like you say, imagine faking your age to go and fight for Keir Starmer or something, you know.
It's just not going to happen.
It's not going to happen, is it? But it's not even, you don't even really want to get in a fight on the street anymore. Yeah. You don't want to, we've changed in such a drastic way. And I don't know, it's hard to gauge whether it's for the worst or not. It's because, you know, like, great things are happening, you know, in the world. But that, I do a lot of travel. Before I did this as well, I did a lot of adventure travel. And you see the same thing in a lot of cultures you go to, where they still live so a little bit more so-called in the past. Their risk appetite, completely different. Climb that tree, scale that mountain, go, you know, cross that river. Like, we'd be like going, hold a minute, let's think about this. They're like, oh, fuck it, let's try it and see what happens, you know. And yeah, I want that back.
Yeah,
I really do. I don't know how we get it back, because I think it takes a group effort. It's like a cultural thing.
It's definitely cultural. Yeah, definitely. Yes, a good question. How do you get that back? I think there's levels to it in the West as well. I think that you go to the US and their appetite for risk is still greater. And I mean, probably more in an entrepreneurial way is the way it's funneled these days. But the appetite for risk in the UK and Europe is just absolutely, it's been destroyed. You know, I think that's a governmental thing. I think that the society's been shaped that way. And it's a great shame, because that's why you don't see the great companies coming out of the UK and in Europe anymore, and they all come from the US.
We should probably try not to make this a whinge about the UK, because I do that too much. I've just been to a Freedom, something called Freedom Fest in the UK. Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Right, I went there, and just literally the day before I came out here, so I was interviewing Brits about Britain. God almighty, you know. I mean, I'm the same. If you let me off the hook, I will just hate on my own country so much. And that's a terrible thing, isn't it? It is a bad thing.
Yeah, though, you know? It is. I mean, I think that in a way, though, that's why Sealand's more important than ever now, because it shows that spirit of adventure. It shows that there is an alternative route. You don't need to keep going down this path of, you know, not believing in yourself, not standing up for what's right and wrong. I don't know. I think that I think it's a really important message, and I think it's getting more important all the time.
The other thing I gleaned from watching that doc was that your granddad was trying to make it profitable, mm-hmm. which the part of it that I didn't know about.
Yeah,
I assumed it was a old quirky British thing, and then it kind of stopped, but mm-hmm. it didn't at all. He was fully mm-hmm. ideologically committed, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. He had great big plans to develop Sealand, reclaim land around it, build hotels and all that kind of thing. It didn't materialize in his lifetime. We've got plans for the future to do similar things, and I hope that we can achieve that. I mean, the early days were very difficult for my family, you know. Everything was paid for out of their pockets, you know. They gave absolutely everything to their dream, their cause, however you want to look at it. You know, they lost their homes over it. They lost any jewelry they had, cars, anything, literally anything you could think of. At times, they sold everything and poured it all into Sealand, like time and time again. And that was in my lifetime too, when I was younger.
So before we go into that side of things, what exactly was your role? Because your granddad started it, your dad grew up on it. I mean, your dad and your sister in that documentary, your dad and his sister, like I say, once again, something you couldn't get away with these days.
Yeah.
The kids would be like, no, dude, I don't want to live out here. take me back to school or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So what was your experience of it, and how often were you there, and what?
I started going out there when I was probably 3 or 4. My dad would start taking me out there, and then it was, you know, school holidays, all those kind of things. We'd be out there.
We're going on holiday. Where are we going on holiday this year? It's like-
Oh yeah, I mean, we never went anywhere else, so that was just how it was.
What a surprise
we
for you.
Yeah, exactly. But it seemed normal, weirdly. I guess when you grow up with it from such a young age, it's whatever. You know, whatever kind of environment you're thrust into.
But like I say, in your granddad and your dad's age, I can imagine it just being par for the course that Brits do weird things. But by the time you get to your age group, did the kids at school think you were weird and stuff?
Yeah, because you didn't have the internet or a phone in your pocket to pull out to show them. So they didn't think I was weird. They just didn't think I was telling the truth. You try and describe what you've been up to over the summer holidays, and they just look at you like, okay. Even the teachers, yeah, okay.
Really? Didn't believe you?
No. So, like, as you think about it now, why would they, I suppose? But
yeah, I mean, exactly. Or why could you even explain it? It doesn't explain very well, does it?
No, what is
it? Like two hollow concrete pillars and a platform, and you can live inside the pillars, right? That's the thing I didn't realize. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they go pretty much all the way to the seabed. Yeah, there's 7 rooms down in those towers. So that's where most of the space is. You know, there's bedrooms, a gym, chapel, all sorts of things down there.
What's the weirdest thing that happened to you out there?
That's a good question. Lots of things. I guess one of the weirdest things as I look back is when my dad taught me to fire a shotgun at about 4 or 5 years old. I thought my shoulder was going to just, I don't know, disappear.
Well, no one's going to tell you off for the noise, are they?
No, exactly. And that might not seem too weird to people in the US, but obviously the gun laws in the UK, that's most people in the UK haven't even fired a gun, you know. So,
but he was thinking, it's like you've got to get into your granddad's mindset here. He wasn't thinking, oh, I'm going to teach you how to shoot a shotgun whatever. He was thinking, I own this place. This is, yeah. I can do whatever I want. Yeah. I think that's a really core idea to get around. That, and I think that's something else that's changed. I think if people did it today, they'd be much more timid about like claiming that thing.
Yeah.
We've had it beaten out of us. We really have.
No, I agree. Yeah, I agree. And that's why I was saying, I think that CLAN becomes more important by the day to show people that these things actually do still go on. There might be an anomaly, but there are examples of like the human desire for freedom and that spirit.
What does the government actually say about it now, if anything? Do you ever have brushes with bureaucracy still?
No. The British government have pretty much, I think, taken a line of waiting for us to disappear.
Right.
You know, because I suppose they thought maybe when my grandpa went that my dad would let it go. And then now that my dad's handed it down to us, that maybe we'd let it go. But if you look back at the old government papers, the ones that have now been declassified and released, there's a big effort to not engage with us, to just kind of stand back, leave it alone, and just wait for it to die out, I suppose.
But I mean, if you think that we're entering a new age, you'll come back on the radar almost certainly.
Yeah,
and it'd be interesting. You're not outside. You're still in British territorial waters, aren't you?
So when my grandfather claimed Sealand, it was in international waters. But then the UK extended their territorial limits to 12 miles. So most people argue that the UK has then claimed Sealand or whatever. But in actual fact, because our claim predates that, there's a median line drawn between overlapping claims. And you can see this all over places around the world. You know, you can't just claim new territory because you've extended your international waters. And there's several parts of international law that guarantee that that's grandfathered in.
And has anyone tried proving that in court or anything? Have you had any legal battles?
Not since the UK extended their territorial waters. But before that, yeah. I'm trying to think of the exact year, but it was pretty early on. A British naval vessel was kind of forcing its way towards Sealand, kind of testing the limits and seeing how we would respond. And my father fired a pistol across, like emptied his magazine across its bow, you know, to give it warning shots. It turned and left. And when he returned to the UK, he got hauled in front of a judge, him and my grandfather. And the judge eventually found that the UK has no jurisdiction. There was nothing that they could do.
See, that's something that I wonder whether would still occur today. I mean, if you fired at a... I don't know. I just think the state has got more audacious.
Mm.
I feel that. I don't know. I don't know whether I can quantify that with truth in this particular instance. But that would make the news. That would, you know... Whereas back there was that kind of politeness amongst British people.
Yeah.
I mean, that high trust society type thing where, you know, the guys driving the ship are like, well, yeah, we're doing something wrong. Whereas now it's like, no, we run this place.
Yeah.
We can do whatever we want. That's the impression I get. I don't know whether it would play out like that in real life, but it's a feeling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, if you have plans for Sealand now, I mean, I see a similarity with Liberland, in fact, and it's kind of at the wacky end of the free city spectrum as well at the same time, but it is a sovereign place, and in the grand scheme of things, you're right at the end, you're at the self-sovereign end, you're right at the absolute sovereignty end, which is the most dangerous one.
Yeah, no, for sure.
To be honest, you know.
Yeah, and we, from that perspective, we have to look after ourselves. You know, we've had several incidents of people trying to take Sealand over. So you have to be your own police force. You have to be, you know, your own military. You're literally responsible for yourself.
Is someone on there 24 hours a day?
Yeah, yeah. Usually at least two people.
Really?
Yeah, they're guarding it and maintaining it.
Who are they?
They're one of the guys. He's been with us for a really long time, but he was involved with pirate radio from when he was a teenager. So he's never really left that, if you think about it, like as a one developed into the other, he's never really left that space.
Is he still broadcasting from Sealand then?
No, he's still very enthusiastic about his radios and things like that. But no, he doesn't broadcast anymore. But he's a real quirky character. I mean, he's seen everything.
So know, just friend of the family or someone who showed an interest and
yeah.
Is he an employee or does he just fund himself or what?
No, he gets paid. We pay him, yeah.
And who's the other person then?
So he's someone that's been with us for, he's been with us about 15 years now. I forget exactly how he became involved. I think he liked Sealand and, you know, it became apparent that he would be suitable to that life.
And what do they do on a day-to-day basis?
Maintenance, mostly. You know, I mean, it's, the place is always being battered by the North Sea, so we need to keep painting it and maintaining it.
Crazy. I mean, I don't know how much you know about Liberland. Have you looked into Liberland quite deeply? Because it has so many similarities, actually, even in the, the idea of expanding something over water, you know, and it, like I say, quite wacky, quite legally weird.
Yeah.
Hard to know what might go on, you know.
Yeah.
But I've been out to Liberland a few times, and they got Zaha Hadid architects to draw them up. And that just shows you what some people think. When I go there, I'm thinking, oh, like a few little houses, it would be really cool here. And then you get someone coming in like that saying, no, we want to build Singapore here, and we want it to be on pillar and like concrete pillars in the water and all this kind of stuff. And is that what? So, what are your plans for it? Like, what have you been thinking about recently?
So, we're currently building out the Sealand e-citizenship. We've got thousands of e-citizens that actually pay monthly to Sealand. I think they truly believe in what we're doing and what we're trying to build. We're building that community out. We've got quite a big global community. Also, we're followed by about 1.5 million people online now.
Really?
Yeah.
On what, social media or on your email lists and stuff like that?
On social media. We've got a big email list and everything, and you know, lots and lots of noble title holders of Sealand. But that's just the social following. And we're building towards launching the Sealand DAO. So essentially, we'll be handing over a lot of the governance decisions to our community. And that'll be distributed so they can still be a part of Sealand from wherever in the world they live. I mean, Sealand e-citizens are in, I think the last time I checked, 124 countries.
Are you ready for the politics? I mean, dude, I mean, life is probably, I know it's hard, but at least it was simple.
Yeah.
You wait till you get like 1.5 million people voting on every single thing you want to do.
Yeah, we're going to try and keep it as streamlined as possible so it doesn't get bogged down, because there's been a lot of like DAO projects that have failed for those reasons, where, you know, the granular decisions are voted on and then people get exhausted from all the voting. And we're going to make sure that we kind of cut through that and take a lot of the lessons of what's
going on. You know, the Veritas Village guys, they've got an interesting one. It's not on a DAO. I think they're building it on top of Bitcoin, but they've got kind of weighted voting. So each member gets 100 votes a year. So you can choose, you could vote 99. If it's something you really care about, you can pop all your votes in one go. But but otherwise, I find that, I don't know, those kind of votes, like how do you decide, you know, if it's 50, like what do you do, 50% or 75? How many people do we need to agree with one of these things? Plus, I'll be honest, you know, your granddad had a vision that probably no one, you get, you know, your average person that signed up online, probably not as invested.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and you can make flippant decisions. I think that's true of the whole democratic system in general. I don't think everyone should be voting on things. To be perfectly honest, you know, it's like, what do we know? What do I know? I know about my local community, but what do I know about?
That's so true.
About other things, you know. Have you got any plans to build stuff on it?
Yeah, we've been talking with a really well-respected marine architect or marine engineer in the Netherlands, Water Studio. I don't know if you know Cohen or have come across him.
No.
He's given us several designs for what Sealand could look like. I guess the one that we love is they're like two like really tall towers coming out of the sea. And you'll be able to, you know, invite people to actually live there, like really grow the physical presence.
Does that mean, how deep's the water there?
It's about 30 feet. It's tidal, but probably an average about 30
so
feet.
So you can still sink pillars down into, I mean, I'm just trying to think through how they did it originally. How do you put concrete pillars in the sea like that?
So it's not actually anchored to the sandbank. So they built the fortresses inshore on like a concrete barge. They literally built them at a shipyard, towed them out, and then sunk them into place on the sandbanks.
Oh, right. So they could go underwater potentially. I mean, they, you know, not that this is going to happen, but if the water rises too far, it'll stay. It's sinking. Is that right?
No, it's just sitting on top of the sandbank.
Yeah, but I mean, if the water, I don't know. Say climate change was real and the water went up, it could actually flow over the top. That's the how you work out how to do it. You basically build it tall enough that it's never going to run.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
So how would you build on that then? How does an architect design things around that then?
I mean, we haven't seen his like in-depth plans because he's just done the kind of high-level ones. He needs to do a load of kind of investigation and engineering designs. But it would be piled into the sandbank below where Sea Lion currently sits.
New pillars?
Yeah. But we would want to ensure that inside of that, we keep some of the old structure or quite a lot of it, because, you know, it's part of the history now. So it'd be such a shame to lose all that.
Have you looked much into the seasteading world as well? I mean, you're quite aligned with them as well.
Yeah. We know quite a few of the guys that are involved in it. It's been going on for quite some time. Their designs kind of and ideas really vary, you know, so it's really interesting there.
Well, the only problem, I suppose, with Sealand is that your location, I mean, your average seasteader probably wants to live on a reef somewhere, or they all do so far.
Yeah.
And you, you know, which is sort of the crazy thing about Sealand, and one of its probably main problems is it's the North Sea, right?
I mean, you could see that as a problem, because if you were going to design where you'd want to live day to day, you would think, you know, like where they've looked like French Polynesia and places like that for the weather. But in actual fact, if you want to be connected, we sit right at the intersection of the Netherlands, you know, like Amsterdam, London, Paris. So it's strategically, it's a really important place. You know, it's in that kind of like blue banana corridor of Europe. So I think that'll be important going forward.
Yeah. So you really are thinking about proper plans for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, tell me what, like, say in 30 years' time then, what do you imagine might be there if things go according to plan?
So, as I say, originally we want to build the towers, but then after that we want to reclaim more and more land, build the community out, have, you know, advanced manufacturing, things like that. That's the real future
Do you mean like dropping boulders onto the ground and building up land like that? When you say reclaim land?
I mean, there's lots of ways of doing it. I mean, you can like sheet pile a perimeter and then backfill it.
So a proper island?
Yeah, exactly.
And how does that work legally? Like when you claim a bit of land, like Sealand, do you get like 6 miles around it or whatever? Like, how does it, you know, what would the law say about what you're doing compared to what everyone else is doing on the planet, you know?
I mean we have our territorial waters. It's not just the fortress that you see, so we would be looking to extend into those.
What are they then?
So 12 nautical miles.
Really?
Yeah. But then where you draw a median line, where the overlapping claim is with the UK.
So you can go all the way out. And what happens when you extend your boundary? Does it extend? It doesn't extend your territorial water. Like, say you eat into your territorial water with an island. What happens?
Yeah,
there?
No, it doesn't. But there's obviously...
Not that it would matter, but like...
Yeah, I mean, then you get into these big questions around international maritime law, you know, with like China building these artificial islands to claim vast, you know, vast areas of the South China Sea. I think... Yeah, a lot of those questions come back to how well you can defend your position. The more you dig into international law and sovereignty and things like that, the more you realise it's a nuanced grey area all over the place.
I think when, because talking to the Liberland lot, I've interviewed all of them over the years, their thing, well, one of their strategies is getting diplomatic acknowledgement from other countries. They've had a marginal success, you know. I think Argentina, and you know, they're good at getting high profile things done. But, you know, what have you ever gone down that route?
No, I know that in the early days, my grandfather used to speak with various like African countries and things like that. I've read old letters of, you know, kind of their foreign offices and things like that, communicating with my grandfather. But these days, it's not the direction at all that we're trying to push in. I think the UN system and the old, you know, nation state ideas don't really align very well with what we're trying to build. We're trying to build more of like an opt-in community, you know, intentional one. And yeah, I think that the old system is slowly decaying more and more.
Agreed. I agree with that. The question is over what time scale and whether or not, I mean, I would guess that if you started dropping like, you know, boulders and backfilling land and all that kind of stuff, they would, I don't know, I think they would probably have to do something about it or at least be seen to be doing something about it. What though? I don't know. I mean, fortunately you've been working on the community for, well, how long is it now? How long has it been going?
Next year will be 60 years.
60 years. So you've got a number of people that would, have you got high profile backers and stuff, or is it just mainly just, you know?
I mean, some, yeah. I mean, there's some like pretty high profile, like YouTubers these days, I guess would be the most relevant ones.
I saw someone. Someone went out there, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah. To be honest, we get requests all the time from YouTubers and the press and everything. And most of the time I say no to the press these days. We do sometimes still take them out there, but it's not really the way to connect with your audience, I don't find. And YouTubers tend to go out there and just with a curious mind, whereas the press usually to put their own slant on it, or yeah, less curious and more of a narrative.
Yeah, they're certainly bringing they're creating the story. Well, I mean, Prosper's done well out of the YouTubers recently. They had exactly the same thing. They had absolute shit show coverage for the first sort of like many years. And then recently, because everyone who came here, a lot of the YouTubers were expecting a kind of hit job of their own in a way. And I don't think any of the YouTubers have done that. They've just come here and gone, because they've understood the principles. They've seen what's going on.
Meet the people actually doing it.
I mean, that is the way to do journalism. It just shows how far. How far we've gone. Something I loved about that documentary, the 60 Minutes one as well, was that originally, talking of radio stations, this is so typically British, isn't it? That they only allowed rock and roll music for 1 hour a day, was it? Is that, and so they just thought, right, well, we're going to go and have a radio station outside of UK waters.
No, so from my understanding, because my dad talks a lot about this, it was 1 hour on a Sunday. They would play the top 20. And so that, it doesn't just mean that you're not getting access to the music, but you're not getting access to open information either. You would literally just have the BBC, that single channel, giving you your news. And that was the internet of the 60s, obviously. Complete dominance and monopoly over information. And I think that's the big reason that my grandpa got involved in pirate radio. He hated that kind of like, that restriction.
It wasn't. Which station was it? Can you remember? It wasn't Radio Caroline, was it?
What, my grandfather's one?
Yeah.
So it was Radio Essex, and then it became Britain's better music station.
Caroline was on a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the other one? There was another one. Was it called Pirate Radio, or was it?
Radio Luxembourg.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That was in the North Sea, right?
Yes, but that was further out.
Have you seen that film, The Boat That Rocked, by the way?
I've actually not watched it.
Haven't you?
No.
It's a great film, mate. It's just a great film. Not because of the storyline necessarily. It's just a really, I mean, I'm really picky about films, but it's really enjoyable film. Okay. I was talking about it with someone the other day, and I couldn't remember whether it was actual based on real life events or whether they just kind of...
I think loosely.
Yeah, Radio Caroline probably, but they don't talk about it in terms of it's actually that radio station, you know?
Okay.
But yeah, 1 hour a week, the charts.
You can't imagine it now. It's so hard to even try and describe that to somebody like a young person today who has access to absolutely everything at their fingertips with their phone.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And over the years, there's been a number of ways to try and monetize the place, right? Like I saw some data centers. Mm-hmm. I mean, ironically, the things that they've been tried there are all things which are happening in the free city space. They are people who basically need to do something and they're struggling in their home and then a nation state or whatever.
Yep.
It's so weird, isn't it, that there are these, you know, like just before I spoke to you, I've just been interviewing a lady in from Brazil. With this, have you heard of this place, Ipe City?
Yeah.
Right. That guy, he built that 45 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He built a privately run city 45 years ago. They just didn't know. Like, if he'd have been doing it now, it would have been, he would have been doing this, basically, 100%. Mm. These ideas are, I mean, I take it you've kind of fallen into this world for the same reason. You think that we're at a cusp, a bit of a change, do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's what drives us. That's why, not why we're still so enthusiastic about it, because I think we always have been with the message and all the rest of it and the kind of culture we've built around it. But I think that's the thing that we really know is going to be the future of Sealand and the way we want to take it. I mean, it is crazy to see the emergence of this culture and the way it's growing and the interest around these ideas of network states, intentional communities, and all those kind of things. I mean, we went to the Network State Conference in Singapore in October, and my dad doesn't really come to many of these things, but we took him to that one, and he could not believe that these people, that thousands of people were in this room to go to this conference all the way in Singapore to talk about essentially the same things he's been doing for 60 years.
What's his backstory then, other than like, I because the to be compelled to do that is one thing, but then to kind of want to continue doing it is quite a big, you know, like, is he, would you call him a libertarian at all? He just didn't know it, or, you know, because back then, before the internet, a lot of these ideas weren't quantifiable.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't label yourself something because you literally never heard of the term, you know.
I think that's exactly true. I was talking to someone about that just yesterday. They were asking me if I'm a libertarian. And I said, well, I've always grown up that way, but I'd never heard the term till I went to the US. They said, so would you describe yourself as a libertarian? And well, tell me more about that term, you know, because that's not something that you'd ever heard. Now, as you say, with the internet and this growing movement, you hear about that kind of thing all the time. But yeah, I mean, you just live it without realizing that you're that thing that...
Well, you don't even need to put a label on it. I mean, the other famous free city in Honduras, Morazan, which is on the mainland, is the only people living there are sort of blue-collar workers from Honduras.
Yeah.
And for all intents and purposes, it's a libertarian city when you actually look at the way it runs.
Yeah.
But they don't know that. They just know that they... And this is the mantra for this industry is... They just want to live somewhere better. They want, and that better means freer. It just, you need to, a lot of people don't make that connection.
Yeah.
But eventually I think everyone does. Yeah. Crikey, I'm just trying to get inside your mindset. Do you think, like now, as you grew up, did you realize that you probably think very differently to other people? I'd give you an example. I grew up typical middle class, you know, like a estate, and as I got older, I earned a bit of money, and I bought a farm. And it took me a few years before I realized my sort of zone of like ownership, and just it started getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And now, when I go to cities, or even staying in buildings like this, when I realize there are people sleeping. You know, when I'm at night, I'm like, bloody hell, there's loads of people sleeping all around here and stuff. I realized how my mind has changed. I'm just wondering what happens when you have it from a very young age, you know. Did you realize you were thinking differently, you know? I mean, has it affected the way you live now, do you think? Obviously, you're in a place like this, so you believe in freedom. But then so do a lot of people, you know.
Yeah. I don't think my mind's really changed much on it, I suppose. Am I a product of my environment with that? Yeah, I guess probably. But the more I've read into libertarianism and, you know, holding governments to account and the argument between the state over the people or the people over the state, it all seems so obvious. And in all the big ways that these different things have been tried out over the last 100 or so years, the results are always the same. You know, the freer countries end up with the much, much better results. It speaks for itself. I find it truly shocking that people want to, literally it's mainstream, you know, in UK and US politics now, to try and go and redo the things that have murdered tens or hundreds of millions of people over the last 100 years. I just I find it shocking. You know, there's still real world examples of these things. You know, Venezuela, Cuba, just go and have a look.
It's the ultimate red pill, actually. The for me, at least, because it took me a while, you know, is realizing that the state is not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah.
It's weird
yeah.
when you start entertaining those thoughts, because to begin with, you feel quite dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that's one of the biggest ideas, I think, that lives in the subconscious of people.
Mm.
And I even find myself arguing on behalf of the state without realizing it quite a lot, because you just expect it to exist. That's why I was asking you about, if you grew up being told that you can do literally pretty much whatever you want, apart from what your mum and dad say you can't do, essentially, and on this place, no one is going to come in and tell you not, apart from your mum and dad, which is obviously the correct way to do it. It must be pretty bloody amazing, you know? I mean, did you go to school?
Yeah. Yeah, I went to school.
Did that? Because that's where most people get it beaten out of them, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. Because you get taught to conform, right? But I think that having Sealand there kind of balanced that out. So I was still able to be, I think, a well-adjusted person to go about your day-to-day life. But still, you know, with those strong ideas in my mind.
What's the longest you've stayed on there in one go?
About 3 weeks, maybe more.
And do you get, what's it called? Cabin fever at all?
No, when I was young, it seemed like a long time, you know, like as everything, I guess your perspective's completely different. But these days it's so comfortable out there. You have the power on all the time, because we have the wind and solar generating power for us, and we have Starlink for the internet. So I end up doing pretty much the same things there as I would do in the UK or anywhere else.
But am I right? You run a fishing business in normally?
Yeah. So in the UK, we have a company. We manufacture and export canned shellfish. Yeah. So it started out, my dad got the fishing boat because we needed to keep Sealand going. So we needed to generate some money. So he had the fishing boat, and that's been in the family. And my brother and I got involved with that as well. And we scaled it to the manufacturing export business.
What, you've got a load of boats now, or do you just do it in the one?
We have boats in several locations around the UK. And then we buy from other boats and people that like hand rake shellfish and things like that all around the UK coast.
And can it yourselves in
Yeah, we can it close to Southend-on-Sea. Yeah, and we export pretty much everything to Spain.
And given the opportunity, would you give that up and devote your time to Sealand?
So I've devoted more and more time to Sealand over the last few years. My brother and I run everything together, like the manufacturing business and Sealand. You know, we plan everything together and pretty much have always done everything together. So he's taken over more of the manufacturing business, which has given me some time to devote to Sealand.
And what about your dad?
He's kind of, he's been retired for a long time now.
From what though? From being from Sealand? Or?
No. I mean, there's no retiring really from Sealand, is there? But more and more he's given James and I the opportunity to handle Sealand affairs.
But did he ever, it's going to sound stupid, but career, or was Sealand his business as well?
So he left school at 14 to help my grandfather found Sealand. He was the one that did pretty much all of the defending when the invasions in the early days, the coup d'etat, all that stuff. That was all my dad. So, yeah, I mean, him and my grandfather always had a business in the UK. It was kind of like a fishing business that they had. They were doing exports at the time as well with the fishing business. But that, again, that was literally to fund Sealand. That was everything they did there was to fund Sealand.
It's like having a vintage car or something, isn't it? It's just tinkering on it, but it's just a money pit.
Yeah, I mean, Sealand didn't become self-sustaining till about 10 or 15 years ago when we started offering noble titles to the community. And it was only really the internet that enabled that. And I don't think we realized, we knew that we had support around the world. We knew that people were really curious about Sealand. But I think when we started offering those noble titles, and more recently the e-citizenship, we realised just how big that community is.
We better go into that then. So I know what the noble titles are because one of our employees got one the other day, I think.
Okay.
Natalie got
one. Oh, yeah. She's the Duchess of Sealand.
So in real terms, right, if, say, in the future, I don't know, it became a, you know, we carry on down the same route. The UN is recognizing countries or whoever it is, I don't know. And Sealand becomes a recognized place. Will these titles be something really, you know, like, or is it a bit of fun kind of, you know?
So they're symbolic. And I don't, we've talked about ways of including them in the governance to make sure that they've got some recognition as we move towards the DAO, because I think that's important. You know, they're people that have literally given their money to help sustain Sealand. And I'm sure there's all sorts of reasons why people buy them, but I genuinely think that most people buy them because they like what we're doing and they think we should exist, you know, and they help fund it.
But like with e-residency, for example, there's a genuine use case for e-residency, because as you can see here, you know, But what's interesting in your case is you can offer e-residency and you don't even have to ask anyone.
Yeah.
But how does it work? Like, say if I incorporated my company, can you do stuff like that yet?
That will be part of the DAO that we're building towards that.
But say I incorporated my company in Sealand, how would that work? Like, what when the British government says... you know, say I live outside of the UK or something, or I move away and I've incorporated in Sealand, so I'm not paying, and I'm paying tax to you guys at a really low rate or whatever. And the government say, come on, we want your tax. And I say, sorry, mate, I'm a Sealand resident. I've incorporated Sealand. How does it work when there's no official documentation? I mean, it would bring it to court, right?
Yeah, presumably. I mean, they could bring you to court in the same way they bring people to court if they incorporate anywhere in the world and they want to try and bring you back under their jurisdiction.
Mostly you incorporate in a real place, like you incorporate in the Cayman Islands or something, whatever, but they recognize the Cayman Islands. The problem with Sealand is like it's not recognized.
I mean, it all falls under private law, you know, private contract law, so it's all doable. I mean, how defensible it is will depend on the country that either that takes issue with what you're doing.
I mean, it's a phenomenal thought. Have you spoken to the Prosper a lot about the way, you know, because, I mean, they've got a platform ready to go, haven't they?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've talked to them, not that deeply. But yeah, I mean, several of the things that they're doing here, like the dynamic ways that you can choose the laws that apply to you and stuff like that, is really, really interesting. Really interesting.
I mean, it's the perfect place to apply it.
Yeah.
Except... that you've got this problem of acknowledgement by other countries. It's a weird one. I mean, like I say, Liberland, this is their major problem now. Liberland, according to me at least, have reached a plateau. You know, here's a funny realization I came to last time I was there. I was there last year. And do you know at Liberland, so they have this bit of land called Gornjasiga, which is the disputed land where Liberland is, where they're trying to settle and the police are always kicking them off and all this kind of stuff. But then over in Serbia on the other side of the river, they just bought an old, it's like a bit like a holiday camp. And that's where they base themselves because it's like they get left alone. And what you realize is that's Liberland, the place in Serbia, because the flags fly in there, everyone's living there. It's actually, they get left alone. When they go into that bit of disputed land, that's when the problems start. And then you realize, okay, Liberland is there's Liberlanders all over the place. Like you've got this in a very extreme case, 1.5 million people living all around the world who consider themselves involved in this. And there's your network state. What that means, hard to say at the moment, because, you know.
Yeah, it seems like a movement that's emerging and emerging quickly. You know, you look at the space, it seems to be, you look at where the... you go to these conferences, every time you go, there's more people trying to start the projects and more enthusiasm for them. And the internet has really brought about the possibility to do that, you know, form online communities that are made with intention. It's all opt-in, you know, you're not just coerced by the place you happen to be born in to live under their laws and their rules and their customs.
What do you think about the sort of the fact that I don't know. My view on the network state side of things is I feel it's less effective at the moment because it doesn't have. It's easy to opt in. Mm. Number one, you just click a button on the internet.
Yeah.
So in a way, your sort of commitment is much lower. Mm. What do you think about that? Do you think there's validity in that or not?
It's hard to say. It's got a long way to go. I'm really interested in the idea of it. I think where CLAND is different and where CLAND becomes the only real viable network state type project is that we actually have the sovereign claim, you know, and the idea of the network state, the whole thesis around it is that you'll be able to gain sovereignty and like kind of in the cloud, but then we're still flesh and bones and we need to live somewhere. And so you're only ever going to be able to solve half of the puzzle that way, whereas CLAND can address both problems at the same time.
Or at least I think the network state has believed that they will form the physical place after.
Yeah, if they can get the community big enough, if they can get 500,000 people to say we all want to move somewhere and have a referendum and maybe there'll be a country that will welcome that. But as I say, right now, I mean, unless that's a long road to get yourself to that.
How long has it been since you've showed a new interest in making things happen? Is it the last couple of years?
With CLAND? Yeah. I would say that James and I have been kind of given the reins by our dad in the last couple of years. And that's where we've really tried to drive the community growth and the new direction forward.
What does he think about it, your dad?
Yeah, he loves it. Yeah, he knows that obviously we're the future of it. And he, when I tried explaining the ideas of where we want to take it, he kind of looked at me like, okay, you know, and a lot of these ideas of rebuilding it have been tried and all the rest of it. But like I say, taking him to things like the Network State Conference and seeing the interest around this stuff now, I think he thinks that it's doable.
There are people building cruise ships for more than $2 billion. You could grab a load of stone and drop it in the ocean. People do that all the time. Mm-hmm. People create islands all the time, mate. There's, yeah. That's not a problem. Mm. Getting the money might be a problem because I think the risk appetite for things like that, especially off the coast of the UK, mm-hmm. I don't know, you're gonna need someone with vision because they're going to come up against a lot of problems. But the engineering thing is nothing.
Yeah, no, for sure.
There was a couple of guys at the conference this year who were thinking of doing islands off the coast of Canada. Mm. Off the coast of, north of USA. And putting data centres on them, funnily enough.
Yeah.
It's because you've got access to water and cooling and all this kind of stuff. What are the main, other than the generating e-residency and the titles and stuff like that, have you got any other business ideas at the moment that are working or in the pipeline?
So the main idea is to create and launch the CLAND DAO, and that will allow things like company incorporation, arbitration, and start building out the economy, because right now the economy is the noble titles and the e-citizenship. But we're going to build it out to be a lot more functional, have actual much broader utility.
Do you know what I love? It's just you're not asking permission. It's so funny. Now think about it.
That's the only way you can drive change, though, isn't it? You can't ask to do anything. The world's regulated. They tell you no. So you just have to go and do it.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's the only way, because I think what I notice about a lot of these projects, and I'm not saying that CLANDS fits this into this category, but you can do a deal with a government, which is a bit of a Trojan horse. Mm. They just don't really get it. We get it. They don't. They see something that you don't. I think Bitcoin's a bit like this. It's a Trojan horse, you know, because it sort of like takes strength away from the people that don't really understand it, you know, I think there's a lot of ways to address this. I love the fact that you could just create a legal framework for incorporating your company in a country and not ask anyone, because really anyone should do this. Yep. The fact you've got an actual place is great, but you don't even need that really, do you?
No, you don't. No, you don't, because it's all digital. And that's most of what the network state projects are. They're digital projects. But I mean, I think the fact that we do have the physical space and we do have the 60-year history and the culture, I think that generates a lot of trust. And I think that's also going to be one of the differentiators going forward, is that, you know, there's a lot of nerves around crypto projects and things like network state projects, that there's going to be a rug pull at some point, you know. But I mean, my brother James and I are the third generation custodians of Sealand. You know, this is our life, and it was my dad's life and his dad and my grandma's life before that. So I think that generates a trust that you can't really.
Have you got kids yourself?
Yeah, I've got two sons.
Has your brother got kids?
Yeah.
What do they think of it? Yeah, four. Cool.
Yeah, he's got two boys and two girls.
That's all right. You're getting a bit more of a population.
Yeah, I mean, my boys are too little right now. They're babies, but my brother's boys, they're a bit older now. But they go out for the summer holidays. They're kind of being brought up in the same way that James and I were, you know, going out there for their school holidays and that kind of thing.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because one of the problems, you see this in farming, don't you? That, you know, as each generation, recently, for many generations, farmers became farmers. And now you see the draw of the modern world, and farmers don't want to be farmers anymore. The new generation are coming through. So that's almost a surprise that your kids, maybe they're too young, maybe, or at least your brother's kids. How old are they? Like, how old's the oldest? Are they teenagers yet?
No, 11 is James.
All right, okay. They might rebel against it. Who knows? Gosh. So think about, like, according to you lot, anyway, the future. Where, like, have you got any plans to go down the route of data center type stuff in the meantime before you would do renovations? You know, those kind of offshore projects that you see cropping up a lot in these kind of places.
I mean, potentially I'd be open to it, but it's not part of our plan right now.
So you think you've got a robust plan to be profitable into the future?
Yeah, absolutely. But things like data centers out there, once we reclaim more land, then absolutely, that's exactly the type of thing that we're going to be looking at.
And when do you start reaching out to wealthy people to create islands and stuff like that? When does that happen?
This year.
Really?
We're going to be starting to talk to people this year.
Wow. So what's your plan? Like, have you got, is this something you've written down and thought, or is it just?
Oh yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's mostly done, the plan. We're going to start reaching out to people probably in the next 6 weeks, I would say. You know, we're just finalizing a few things. We're going to announce what we're doing and then start building the tech and then launch the DAO.
And then what about like physical structures and stuff like that? Is that something in the distant future? Or?
So the first thing we're going to do is upgrade some of the infrastructure to get on and off Sealand so that we can take larger groups of people out there, have events out there and things like that. Because it's quite tricky right now.
Is it still that thing where you have to...
The bosun's chair. Yeah. Yeah, still the bosun's chair.
60 years. Come on, mate. You should have changed that, surely.
Yeah, maybe. It's part of the adventure of the whole thing. People will do either love it or hate it.
Yeah, but once you get a... I don't know. What will you do? A mooring and then steps or something, maybe?
Yeah, it just has to be done with the view that you have to keep the place secure. It's not as simple as just putting a, you know, like a dock type structure on the side of Sealand.
Oh, really?
Because people just pull a boat up and, well, we've been invaded before many times.
So. That's what I was going to ask you about. You said you mentioned a coup d'etat. Mm. Is that the one? Is that the Italians or is it Germans that I saw?
Yeah, mainly Germans.
Typical
yeah.
bloody Germans. Yeah. Can't stop invading people.
Just marching in and taking things that aren't theirs.
Tell us about that quickly then. Look.
Yeah, so in 1978, my grandfather was putting a deal together with, it was a consortium of Germans mainly, to reclaim land around Sealand and do kind of the whole thing that we've been talking about.
Really?
Yeah, and then so they invited my grandparents to Austria to sign the deal, essentially. But what they were really doing was luring them out there.
No.
Yes.
Dastardly.
When they were there, a helicopter showed up. My dad was on Sealand on his own and started winching people down. And they basically kidnapped my dad, threw him in one of the rooms. He was, over the next few days, they starved him of food and water. They were tussling with him, and they eventually released him. So they put him on a trawler back to Holland. He managed to make his way back to the UK, regrouped with my grandfather, and they hatched a plan to take Sealand back because they'd got word that it was going to be reinforced by, I think, Belgian paratroopers in the coming days. So they said, we need to act right now. So
why? What the fuck, mate? Like, come on.
This guy just wanted to write my grandfather out of the plan. He still intended to create the island and do the whole thing, but he thought, why share it?
Who was that guy then?
He was turned out to be a very shady.
I was going to say, do you know his offspring? Is it going to like progeny?
Because thankfully, I don't. No,
that's insane. See, that's once again something I don't think would happen anymore.
No,
would it?
No,
it's insane.
And the way they responded, they didn't just take it lying down. It was their immediate reaction was, okay, we're going to go and take it back.
Let's get to
whatever that looks like, you know. And so they. Coincidentally, one of my grandfather's good friends was a James Bond stunt pilot. He flew in many of the Bond movies. and they asked him if he would fly them out there, and he said yes. So they made a plan. At dawn, they went, took the doors off his helicopter. They're armed with pistols and sawn-off shotguns, piled into the helicopter, swept across the North Sea, abseiled down onto Sealand and stormed it and took it back.
I did see a bit in that documentary. Was that real footage of them? They were kind of like some.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The prisoners. They took them. Yeah, that was real. So one of the guys actually held a Sealand passport. One of the guys that was involved. So they released the others, but they kept him prisoner, and they convened a trial and found him guilty of treason.
And did what?
Locked him in the Sealand jail at the bottom of the North Tower for 3 months.
3 months.
Yeah, they kept him for 3 months.
Oh my God!
Germany lobbied the UK.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. It was a big diplomatic thing. Yeah.
So the Germans said you need to fix this to the UK, and they said there's nothing we can or will do. We don't have jurisdiction over Sealand. So Germany sent a diplomat directly to Sealand to negotiate for his release, which of course is diplomatic recognition. I mean, you know, talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God, mate, that is insane. Like, I'd love to think that things like that could still happen now. Do you know that guy anymore, the one who was in prison with the passport?
No. My dad's tried to find him in recent years to see what happened to him. But there seems to be no trace of him, but he was a lawyer. I think he probably changed his name and tried to disappear.
So the people that tried to take it were basically doing it as a business move as well, because they really did want to do that.
Yeah, yeah, they saw the potential and thought, we're going to build this island, but we don't want to share it.
That's also great validation, right? Yeah. I mean, the Germans normally now, they're a bit of the laughing stock, but back then,
yeah,
they were building, you know, good cars and stuff. They were
absolutely.
Oh, that's so insane. So we'll wrap up and say, what do you think? Talk me through a sort of timeline of the future, you know, going forward that you reckon. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I think. I mean, I it's news to me. I think I get this a lot talking to, you know, people outside of this world, is when you're in this world and talking about this stuff all the time, you don't realize just how involved you become when you go outside and realize everyone's got, like, a bit like I'm getting now listening to what you're saying. I'm thinking, yeah, you've been thinking about this stuff for years. Mm. It's really, you know, everything about it. You've thought all the thoughts. Mm-hmm. And it does sound weird to me. And I keep having to check myself going, yeah, of course. You know, Liam's thinking like this because of this. I'm fresh in just trying to kind of soak it all up. Mm. So what do you think, you know, the plans that people would, you know, normal people would understand going forwards, I suppose. That's the way to describe it.
So to describe it in that way, we're going to open up Sealand. Well, we're going to build the e-citizenship. To a point where hopefully we've got millions of e-citizens. Those e-citizens are going to be able to vote on the future of Sealand, help build the future of Sealand, and then when we build the two towers in the North Sea, they're going to be able to come and stay there and live there.
Live there?
Yeah. We want a big permanent community.
What? Like what? How many people?
I suppose initially around 50 could live there on those towers, maybe more, including office spaces and things. But once we start reclaiming land, I mean, the sky's the limit, really.
Oh, yeah, I keep forgetting that part of it. You're absolutely right. You're basically going to create, pretty much creating an, the plan is to create an island,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Bloody hell.
It's not the first time it's been done.
What, making an island?
I mean, Venice.
Yeah.
I mean, that. This is a, you know, when people say to me, like, it can't be a country, it's man-made. I said, well, Venice was a sovereign state for like nearly 1,000 years.
It's the most successful city in history, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And it was all man-made, just, you know, driving piles into a lagoon.
Yeah, the I don't know. I don't know enough about the history of Venice to know how much. I mean, I think the reason nobody bothered them mm-hmm. was because of the strategic location, mm-hmm. which you've got to a degree. But in this modern world, they could send some drones out and do whatever they want, couldn't they? Yeah. God, I can't wait to see what happens, mate. I cannot wait to see what happens. Really phenomenally exciting. Totally, like I say, I talk to everyone in this space. And you get the kind of out there people who just are doing shit.
Yeah,
you're definitely in that category. I love it. you've got, like I say, I think it comes from many years of just knowing what you're doing, mm-hmm. That you can be that resolute about it.
Yeah, we've lived this life, and my dad has, and my grandfather before him, and we're sure of where we want to take it. And It's not just dreams. I mean, it's grounded in reality. We've got a plan of how to get there. Now we just need to go and do it.
And that actually, I mean, I find that in legal battles as well, is when you feel you have the moral right, mm-hmm. you actually would go one step further than the opposition because they're just defending.
Yeah, exactly. The status quo. I mean, and I feel like we have a responsibility to do this. You know, we've got quite a big community that's growing quickly and people want to see this. They want this to exist. So I think it's something really, really important. And I've got a duty to my family as well. You know, that's a big part of it.
You have. Prince Liam, isn't it? Was your dad wasn't the king, was he?
No, so there's a, because it's a principality, you have a sovereign prince.
I don't know how that works. Is that prince, that's where prince, God, I've never made the connection before, principality comes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it was only set up as a principality to simplify the law because essentially the prince's word is the law.
So how does that, what's the difference between that and a country or a state or whatever?
No, it's the same. It's just the way that it's formed, you know, instead of a kingdom or a republic or those kind of things. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, look, Liam, I'm like, I was going to say I'm on board, but it wasn't meant to be a joke. It's a brilliant idea. And I'm just super happy that you can actually have those thoughts because, you know, I know we're all a little bit weird in this world, in this particular industry, but that's a bold idea. But as I break it down now in my mind, yeah, it makes absolute sense. It makes, why wouldn't it succeed? I just can't wait just to see what happens.
Me too.
Anyway, look, mate, thanks for coming in and thanks for telling us all about it. I'll put all the connections, I'll put all the links and everything in the show notes if people want to. Okay. Tell me quickly about what people can get, like duchess, dukes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so
it's an important part of your business model at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. So we offer noble titles. It's kind of a cool way to get involved in the community and help fund Sealand. So Lord, Lady, Baron, Baroness, Duke, Duchess, that kind of thing. And we offer, as I say, the e-citizenship. So that's they're the two ways that we fund.
And at the moment, what can you get with the e-citizenship?
So you get a VPN, a Sealand email address. You can get a Sealand ID card on your phone. We make a donation to an ocean cleanup charity every month on your behalf. And we're also building that out to those are going to be the guys that are going to be able to vote in the DAO and all the governance stuff.
And if I get a duchy or a duke, can I put that on my passport?
I've seen people do it. I won't tell you that you can because I know that some people have tried and failed, and I know some people have tried it and done it. But
or at least your driving license.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen people do it. It's cool.
Right, I might have to give that one a go. Anyway, mate, thanks. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Right, you made it to the end of the show, so I'm going to go ahead and assume that you got some value out of this episode. If you want to help the show, please follow or subscribe right now. It takes only 2 seconds and it massively helps. If you've got another 30 seconds, well, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Honest reviews, apparently, are the single best way to help new listeners find us. If you want more, you can get bonus episodes and early access to episodes on fountain.fm for the price of one coffee for a whole month. Or you can support the mission by streaming sats on any of the value for value platforms, or use the Bitcoin and fiat donation links in the show notes. Every contribution to the show makes a real difference, believe me. And one more thing, if you know someone who'd love this episode, share it directly with them. That personal share beats every algorithm in the book. All the links, the community, and the newsletter are in the show notes. And jump on over to freecities.fm for a deep dive into all the episodes with descriptions and more. That's the new Free Cities podcast website, freecities.fm. Have a good week and see you next time.